Thank you for the introduction. We're delighted to be here today to have the opportunity to present our work on validation of home telehealth for assessment of transfer mobility in patients with a spinal cord injury or disorder. First, neither I nor my co-presenter, Max Halverson, have any financial relationships to or with commercial interests to disclose. We'd like to acknowledge our collaborators, Douglas Oda, Michelle Hill, Jenny Karatli of the Spinal Cord Injury Center at the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. We'd also like to acknowledge the participants who provided time and information and the evaluators who conducted the assessments. And this work was supported by the Department of Veterans Affairs Rehabilitation Research and Development Service and the Health Services Research and Development Service. Basically, home telehealth is the application of telemedicine into the patient's home. And most applications utilize ordinary telephone lines. But another alternative appealing telehealth modality is video conferencing, because it offers the opportunity for the healthcare provider to see as well as hear the patient. And for certain conditions associated with spinal cord injuries, such a modality could be extremely valuable for conducting assessments. First, we want to give you an idea of how many patients have spinal cord injuries in the nationwide. There are 44,000 veterans who have spinal cord injuries or disorders, and we estimate that there are probably about 25,000 who are being followed by the Veterans Health Administration. So it's a substantial group. We think that telehealth has great potential for improving access to care, especially in situations where patients live in remote areas or outside of a home health care catchment area. And again, for spinal cord injury patients, travel from a remote area to a center specializing in spinal cord injuries can be especially challenging. Second, we think it has great potential for facilitating frequent monitoring of patients. Again, this could be extremely important for certain conditions associated with spinal cord injury. One of the most serious secondary conditions is the development of pressure ulcers, which can lead to very long hospitalizations, sometimes 3 months. And that has a huge impact on both the individual and family. Third, we think it has great potential for implementing proactive corrective interventions as needed. And one of the things that's important for preventing pressure ulcers is to be able to perform a transfer from, for example, a wheelchair to a bed, to be able to do that properly. Because if it's not done properly, and if the individual consistently scrapes up against the surface, that kind of rubbing can lead to the development of a pressure ulcer, which is what you want to prevent. So properly performing a transfer is very important. So we feel that finally, in implementing proactive corrective interventions as needed can be done with telehealth, home telehealth, prior to the next in-person visit, and has the potential of preventing these complications. So while there's general consensus regarding the potential value of home telehealth, the extent to which telehealth can yield valid, reliable assessments related to secondary conditions associated with spinal cord injury or disorder are essentially lacking. People just don't know how accurately can they be done. And the conditions that we were interested in the larger study that was funded were pressure ulcers, transfer mobility, and spasticity. And the reason we're interested in spasticity is that can actually either help or hinder with one's ability to perform a transfer. The objectives of the study that we're reporting on today is to evaluate the reliability of home telehealth for assessing a transfer from a wheelchair to a bed. We were interested in evaluating two home telehealth modalities. First was telephone, and the second was video conferencing. Here we just include a link to a very good instructional video on how to properly perform a transfer from a wheelchair to a bed. We aren't going to show it to you now due to time constraints, but we encourage you to take a look at it at another point. It's very good, and it's not very long either. We recruited 54 participants with a diagnosis of spinal cord injury or disorder. In order to be eligible, they had to have a level of independence for performing transfers without the assistance of another person. We had three evaluators in this study, and they were trained according to the study guidelines in assessing someone's transfer from a wheelchair to a bed. Basically, we had three modalities, three conditions where we assessed transfer mobility. Again, the telephone condition and the video conferencing condition, and then an in-person condition, which we considered to be the gold standard. And what we wanted to do was basically compare how accurate were the assessments in each of the telehealth conditions. How accurate were they in relationship to the in-person condition? How much did they agree with what the in-person assessment was like? All of the assessments were conducted at the research site, so we didn't actually do them in the participant's home. Instead, we created a setting which was designed to simulate a home setting. So it was a room that had a bed, a nightstand, a lamp, and then it was equipped with a video cam system. And then there was a separate room that was used by the evaluators in the telehealth modalities. And that allowed the evaluators to, or at least the one in the video conference modality, to remotely control the video camera with a had a pan, tilt, zoom capability. The evaluators were physical therapists who had training in doing assessments of secondary conditions associated with spinal cord injuries. Before we proceeded with the study, they went through rather intense training in order to ensure that there was a high level of inter-rater reliability among the three of them, as well as an expert in spinal cord injury assessments, a physician, the actual principal investigator on the study, Douglas Oda. After they had achieved that, and if there was any issue at all, they went through additional training until they had achieved a high level of inter-rater reliability. And then when we proceeded with the study, we basically randomized each evaluator to a modality for each participant in order to try to eliminate any issues associated with systematic bias due to a specific evaluator. We also randomized the order of the modality. In the case of the video conference and the in-person conditions, we actually wanted to make sure that the evaluators were observing the same transfer. So those two conditions were conducted, the assessments were conducted simultaneously. And then we were randomizing the order in terms of whether the telephone condition was done first before the other two conditions, or whether the telephone modality was conducted after the video conference and the in-person assessments. And again, this was to try to address any issues that might be associated with the order in which the assessments were done. So the participants were instructed to perform a transfer from a wheelchair to a bed. In the case of the video conference and the in-person conditions. In the telephone condition, they were asked to respond to a structured interview, and they were basically asked questions about each element of the transfer. For example, when you conduct a transfer, how do you position your wheelchair? Where are your feet when you're going to conduct a transfer? What's the position of your head and shoulders in relation to your toes and your knees? Those kinds of questions. And then the assessment was basically whether or not they answered in a way that would indicate that they were doing their transfer properly. After the assessments were conducted, the evaluators answered questions about their own clinical confidence in their assessments. So the unit of measure was the participant's transfer from the wheelchair to the bed. And the overall assessment was whether or not they performed the transfer safely. Now, the transfer was actually broken down into 9 specific elements. And again, each of these was also evaluated. For example, wheelchair position. If it was a manual wheelchair, did they put it at a 30-degree angle to the bed? If it was a power wheelchair, was it parallel to the bed? Were the brakes locked if they had a manual chair, or was the power off if it was a power chair? Were the feet on the ground? Were the knees anterior to the ankle? Was the head over the toes and the shoulder over the knees? In terms of the transfer position just prior to moving onto the bed, were the buttocks on the front half of the cushion in the case of a manual chair, or were they moved forward in the case of a power chair? Were the elbows locked? Was there gluteal clearance? That was there at least 2 centimeters of clearance between the buttocks and the surface when they actually were moving onto the bed? And again, this is to make sure that they aren't scraping any surfaces. And then finally, was the trunk stable and upright after the transfer? And then the evaluators were asked to respond to a question about their confidence of the assessment, their clinical confidence, on a scale of 1 to 5, from not at all to very. And they were also asked if there was anything that would have helped improve their clinical confidence, such as seeing the patient in person, touching the patient, more light for seeing, better video quality, audio quality, or better angle or view of the patient. Next, my co-presenter, Max Hamilton, will present the results and conclusions.
So thanks, Ruth, for that great setup. And now I'm going to present the results of our study. So first, just a little overview of the participant characteristics. So this is pretty representative of a veteran sample, predominantly male. In our case, about 80% of the participants were non-Hispanic white, and then we had lower percentages, under 10% each, of Asian, Hispanic, African-American, and other racial categories. And just a little recap. And this first slide is just showing an overview of our raw data, basically. So the percentage of participants in each of these elements of transfer that completed successfully that element. So the yellow is the telephone condition, the light blue is the video conferencing, and that purple is the in-person assessment. So the main thing we noticed is that the levels are pretty high, above 50% for most, all the way up to 90% for some of the others. And in general, you can see that the bars are kind of generally around, you know, similar. And we'll look a little bit more carefully at what the actual levels of assessment were, both for these individual elements of transfer and also overall. And again, just a little recap with text. So this first general slide of agreement is looking at just agreement in whether or not the participant safely completed the transfer. So in addition to assessing the overall individual elements of transfer, the clinician would judge whether or not the transfer was performed safely. So the green bar represents that in 85% of cases, the video conference or the provider who gave their video conferencing assessment agreed with the in-person assessment of the gold standard of safety, safely completing a transfer. Whereas for the telephone condition, 65% agreed with that in-person assessment. And then if we want to look at a little bit more rigorously that agreement, we use the Kappa statistic, which just looks at agreement above and beyond what you expect due to chance. So 0.7 is a very high Kappa statistic, so substantial to almost perfect is kind of the scale that the developers of the scale use, these kind of benchmarks. So very high agreement between the video conferencing condition and the in-person condition. And actually fair to moderate would be the judgment of the agreement between the telephone condition and the in-person gold standard. So fairly high overall agreement, and we can see that above chance they're assessing similarly to an in-person clinician. And now if we were to drill down a little bit on those agreement levels, we can see two things. So first of all, agreement is, again, relatively high, as we saw with those the first graph with the three bars, we saw kind of relative agreement, but then here again, proportion agreement was pretty high across the board. And also, each of those green bars is higher than the purple bar. So for each individual element of transfer, the video conferencing did a little bit better than the telephone assessment in agreeing with the in-person gold standard. And most importantly, well, one of the most important measures we had was whether the clinician was actually confident in their assessment. So, like Ruth mentioned, we asked them, how confident were you in your assessment of this person's transfer mobility safety? And in the telephone condition, about half of them said they were either confident or very confident, and the rest of them, the other 48% or so, said that they were either not at all confident, not so confident, or just okay. But then if we look at those two bars on the right, in the in-person condition, all the clinicians were either confident or very confident, and I think it's 97 or 98% in the video conferencing condition were either very confident or confident. So clinicians really felt quite confident that with this video conferencing technology, they were able to confidently assess someone's transfer mobility safety. So 97% was that number. And we also wanted to know if, in both for the video conferencing condition and for the telephone condition, if there was anything else that could have helped their confidence. So in the in-person condition, in the telephone condition, we see that a lot of them would have really liked to see their patient in person. They would have felt more confident, 90%, almost all of them, would have felt more confident if they had seen the participant in person. Only 50% in the video conferencing condition said that they thought that would help. And then 41% of these video conferencing clinicians thought that the video quality could have been better. If they had better video quality, that would help with their confidence. And these are sort of a little more background on the video conferencing software, or I guess hardware, is that you're able to use this type of hardware through landlines. So it's very, very useful because you can deal with rural veterans who don't necessarily have internet access. But the drawback is that the video quality ends up not being as good as, say, Skype or some more modern technologies. And again, just those results. And these are on your handout so you can peruse. So, yeah, just to recap a little bit more, video conferencing assessments were closer to in-person assessments in their reliability of assessing a transfer overall, safety overall. So the most important thing is, are these individuals performing their transfer safely in a way that's not going to harm them, not going to cause pressure ulcers, etc. And secondly, individual elements were able to be pretty reliably assessed through these telemedicine modalities. and also video conferencing was a little bit superior. So excellent clinical confidence in the video conferencing condition, and substantially lower clinical confidence in the telephone condition. Still, half of the clinicians said either very confident or confident, and rates of agreement were definitely above chance, but not as good as the video conferencing. So we really believe that video conferencing is very reliable enough, hopefully, to be used to increase access to more frequent monitoring of transfer mobility. So, for example, many, many veterans live in rural areas, or in which case they spend a lot of money to transport themselves to a facility, or they just, for whatever reason, have difficulties getting from A point A to point B. So this is a way to save costs for the veteran, for the healthcare system, in some ways by having these quick remote assessments. It's also a way to facilitate rehabilitation efforts to proactively prevent these serious conditions. So having seen someone in the clinic, you might want to just check on them every so often, be proactive. This technology really helps facilitate those kinds of efforts. And ultimately, what we want to do is enhance quality of care and quality of life for spinal cord injury and disorder patients. Thanks a lot, and yeah, thank you.
Okay. I'm checking one last time to see if Scott Robertson has arrived. So I don't know if he's going to still be on the Senate committee, but hopefully the committee will continue to care about this. Before I open to the floor, questions and conversations, I thought I'd ask each of the presenters to make one comment about if you were going to recommend what would be next stage research related to the work you've just done, what would it be? So, Chandra?
I would say probably one of our major limitations of the study was aggregating the definition of assistive devices. Eventually, we want to go a step further in our research and look at specific assistive devices and see if there are differences by race.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you. I think I alluded to the fact that I almost think that the news that from the analysis seems very positive, and I'm seeing a couple Glenn is concurring my thoughts as well. So I think if it were possible, I would love to conduct qualitative interviews with the parents who responded and really understand sort of their navigation to the system. Why did they, how did they do it? Why did they feel so positive experience coming out of it? And if this is an experience that we can emulate in other places, it would be really, really helpful for those parents that I know that can change and have new challenges in this process.
And Ruth or Max, what's next?
The VA has moved ahead with telehealth for assessments for pressure ulcers, but at the present time, nothing is being done in terms of assessing spinal cord injury patients for whether or not they are properly conducting transfers. And I don't know if I call this research, but I think moving ahead with implementing telehealth for also assessing a transfer might have an impact on preventing pressure ulcers. And that they might want to consider doing that. I just checked this morning with my colleague in the Spinal Cord Injury Center to see if they were doing any of it, and apparently not from transfer mobilities at this point in time. In terms of research, I think ultimately the goal is to improve the outcomes for the patients with spinal cord injuries, and that includes prevention of pressure ulcers. So it would be interesting to do some research and see if the home telehealth, especially monitoring patients for transfer mobility and conducting corrective rehabilitation training for those who need to work on their transfer mobility skills, whether or not ultimately that does prevent the incidence of pressure ulcers and the quality of life for the veterans. So focus on outcomes.
Okay, opening it up to the floor. Aubrey Lee, round two.
Barber pronunciation. Excuse me, natural related to that methodological study, but the habit to transfer from the bed back to the wheelchair, because that seems to me to be just as much a risk factor for pectoral generation as transfer from the wheelchair to the bed.
Sure, I think one could do that as well. Yes, of course. For this particular study, because it was done at the research site, I don't think we encountered those issues of information security. But I know that for the home telehealth that's being conducted for monitoring for pressure ulcers, they have actually given in the case of caregivers, for the veterans who are in remote areas, they've given the caregivers digital cameras to take pictures of suspected pressure ulcers, and they are transmitted through some secure mechanism to the clinic. I don't know the specifics, but it is possible to get through all the security issues. It's a challenge, no question about it, but it is possible. You just need some kind of mutual encryption system.
What are the parents thinking, and would really like to delve into what their perspectives are.
Well, Well, I'm coming over to this person. Could you just comment about whether or not there's a bias in your sample? Like, are they all from children with special health care needs, specialized clinics, primary care medical homes?
Well, so it's a national survey, so it's not from a particular clinic. It's a telephone survey, so there's both, they have contacted folks that have landline access as well as cell phone access for this 2009-2010 survey. So it's not sort of biased by the survey population per se, but you know, there are some inherent selection biases for any telephone surveys conducted.
Hello, my name is Allison, and I'm with the University of Michigan. I'm actually going to share the same question about the topic of South and Southern Foundation question. I'm wondering, does it have any additional questions that was asked for by very detail and why parents printing the new format? Or could there have been other questions that, in what way would the new format happen?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I don't know if you're in the University of Michigan biomedical engineering program, because that's where I graduated from, so just a shout out to University of Michigan. I think there are other questions within the survey, but not specifically connected with assistive devices, and so I hesitated to include them in the analyses. And certainly there are questions regarding, you know, financial burden. Yesterday, I presented sort of parental health and well-being in dealing with all of the challenges of navigating this complex system. And so I hesitated to bring all those other elements into the analysis because that it is sort of parental perceptions of the overall access to healthcare that may not be specifically looking at assistive technology. So that was sort of my considerations in doing that.
I'm Linda Blom-Malil from the University of Massachusetts Medical School. At the risk of being greedy, I have two quick questions for the first two speakers. My question to Lynn is, I wonder when I see the results, whether the parents are happy with whatever they've been given, but they don't really know what's possible with technology, and that might at least in part explain your results.
The first assignment that I got when I got to West Virginia was to go to this camp called Camp Gizmo. And in this camp, it's funded by the Department of Education in West Virginia. And we had camp activities for the children, and the families of kids with developmental disabilities would come to this camp. The parents were in this learning about assistive technology legislation and how to advocate for your child, and these are all the things that you need to be aware of going into the individual education plan meetings, IEP meetings, and I, because it was my first summer going into a real job, I said, well, if the folks at the department was doing their job, would we need to have Camp Gizmo? You know, and I think the fact is, it is a really, really, we've created this really, really complicated system for parents, and if you talk to any of them, it is so challenging to navigate through it. I know that there are a lot of gaps in knowledge within the parent community, and it depends on what kind of parental support group they've tapped into, what their neighborhoods are, how much research, and how much of parent have time to dedicate to looking at resources and knocking on doors and taking all the different no's, rejections, and just fighting through it. So I think that what you raise is very valid, sort of, you know, what is the scope of knowledge the parent has, and are they reflecting upon the fact that this is what they think is possible, and they're pretty happy with what they got. So.
Right. My question for the first speaker is, do your findings cause you to reflect on the adequacy of the Veterans Administration's efforts to supply people with assistive technology?
I think that's a very good question. I think they do reflect on the Veterans Administration. However, I think that there are other factors that we for example, employment, just for example, whites were like 4 times as likely to use assistive technology compared to blacks who were like 2 times as likely. So I think there are external factors that we need to consider.
I also have a question that pertains mostly to the two of you. As I was listening, one of the things that struck me most saliently about both of your presentations is that it was really about outcomes, right? It wasn't about pathways. And to me, in order to understand the outcomes, we have to understand the pathways to those outcomes as well, which I think is hard to do in many secondary data sets, right? So it's kind of built off some work that I'm doing. I should introduce myself. I'm Matt Bogatruz from Virginia Commonwealth University. One of my hats is working for the RRTC on employment of people with physical disabilities. So I'm wondering, for both of you perhaps, if what you foresee as potential next steps in starting to build an understanding of the pathways to assistive technology, not just what the outcomes are.
I think, again, that is a very good question, and I think this is what we see with a lot of health, in health generally. You have to explore the reasons why we get to that specific outcome. So eventually, I think we will look at more of those factors. The RSA data set, particularly the 911 data set, was very limited, and we've done a couple of studies with the utilization of assistive technology and also racial differences. And a lot of the data sets are very limited in those factors. So in terms of the next steps, we do want to eventually collect some qualitative data. Right now we're working on securing a couple of grants to maybe do some qualitative studies to look at those pathways.
I have a couple of thoughts, but I don't know if it'll fully answer your question, because I think there are some ways, different ways in which folks are seeking assistive technology, and we really don't know what that is. We could set out to create or use an existing theoretical framework for health behavior, for example, whether that be, you know, the social ecological model or health belief model, you know, you name it, and test whether or not those pathways exist and do they really matter? Do we know the direct and indirect relationship between the variables that sit within that the whole environment? And so I don't know that we have fully expanded upon that area of research to really understand the mechanisms that are at play within that individual's interpersonal environment, interpersonal variables that affect them, or the broader community policy arenas that interact with that individual in accessing service. So I'd be really interested in what you're doing as well, if you're willing to share about how you're tackling these issues through your research.
I wanted to go to the telehome help project. I'm Meg Tracy, and I'm from the University of Montana, and so I am very interested in interventions that have reached rural populations. This is kind of in the rubric of the acceptability of the intervention to rural vets, and I'm just wondering if that's part of what you've looked at, and or does this project sit within a broader needs assessment of rural vets, and whether or not we understand if there are differences in pressure sore rates among rural vets versus those living in more metropolitan areas.
I don't know right off whether there are differences. I think we could try to find out. This was part of a study where I think there was just a lot of interest in home telehealth, but this was, and people were moving ahead with home telehealth, and nobody had really stepped back to see how accurately can one actually conduct these assessments, and so that was the main purpose of the study. this was a larger study, so where we also did do assessments of pressure ulcers and spasticity in addition to transfer mobility. We were just reporting on the transfer mobility part already. We already published the results on the assessment of pressure ulcers. And we did find that it was possible to also accurately assess pressure ulcers, presence of a pressure ulcer, and the stage of a pressure ulcer within one stage. We did a pretty good job. But when you got down to the fine element of the characteristics of the wound, it varied depending on the specific characteristic that somebody was, you know, was looking at. But I think the, you know, within the VA, for example, the Palo Alto VA healthcare system has a special spinal cord injury center that's the hub center for a rather large region that includes Hawaii and even the Philippines. So you can immediately see the issue of trying to bring them in to see them in person. And there is a sort of hub and spoke system where the Palo Alto Center is the hub, and there are spoke clinics, for example, in Honolulu, where a patient might come there and to the clinic, and then there'd be in-person assessments conducted there. The level of expertise of the clinicians there might not be quite as high as it is at the hub center, but I think things have already been set up where there are digital images that are transferred, that sort of thing. But I think, you know, access is clearly an issue for veterans and for, you know, beyond, and this is one way, I think, where we could address access. General.
And I think another implication of your question is kind of how receptive are veterans to this type of technology, and I think that's another area of research that we should pursue. I think a lot of people in our own center and around the VA are thinking about this kind of patient-centered model of care. So yeah, it's important to us not just to think about whether it's effective, but also will patients use it if it's available.
I actually have the proposal for this study with me, and they actually did ask the veterans, or the most of them were veterans, not all of them, there were a few non-veterans who were in this study, actually they did ask them questions about how comfortable they felt with the telehealth modality, and they were essentially fine with it. 93% felt comfortable participating in the telehealth session. They felt that the visit was better due to the technology, 91%. 84% said they would prefer the telemedicine consultation in the future rather than travel to the spinal cord injury center. So they were pretty positive about it. Does that help?
I feel a need to like channel Scott, who's not here, because I want to take a few minutes and see either from the audience or from the panel. If you want to talk about access from an affordability point of view, surely in the telehealth circumstance, you might be able to argue medical cost savings, but assistive technology sits in this funny world between, you know, early intervention and school-based interventions and independent living strategies and both rehab and support employment and then medical necessity. And so I was actually surprised at Chandra's findings that Medicaid was a predictor of less likelihood that these veterans, so maybe it's about their dual status, were likely to be getting AT, because often Medicaid's been the only entity that pays for it. And there's some optimism, and I think Scott was going to speak to this, about the new categories, required categories of rehabilitation and habilitation in the Affordable Care Act and the 10 essential benefits that the exchanges are supposed to be covering. But as everybody started scratching the surface of that, it's actually not looking so promising. And I think there's already negative news out of California around certain aspects of DME in terms of the quality issues, cheaper ear hearing aids, inadequate wheelchairs. And so getting to assistive tech that maybe facilitates your communication and integration can be really way down the pike. So right now I'm actually sort of pessimistic about payment-related issues, and I thought I'd open this up to the floor or the panel for comments.
One thing that is positive about the VA is that the VA has the same patients over the course, a lot of times, of their life after the military. So they do accrue the benefits in this unique way. So, I mean, there may be different incentive structures, but within the VA, at least, there's this kind of positive aspect.
As a member of Physicians for a National Health Program, I think we need a universal health care national health program, single payer system, and that would go a long way to solving so many of these problems.
Well, I certainly agree with the universal piece, but I'm still worried that assistive tech is always in service to medical necessity and medical savings, even if we have single payer. And I'd like it to just matter for independent living and integration on its own. But other comments? Any questions for folks?
Jean, I'll just add, so I volunteer on the board of the Maryland Assistive Technology Loan Program, and we get about between 2 to 5 loan applications per week for board members to review. And so I feel like they're, I don't know how many doors the family or the individual with disabilities have knocked before they come to us, but I mean, we're still seeing that steady stream, that continual need to have that low interest rate program. And so I think people certainly have not identified a great strategy moving forward, and it really warrants the fact that, these alternate financing plans need to continue to exist to fill in that gap.
This is just a comment that I'm channeling from my colleagues, just the incredible cost of adaptive sports equipment. So as we look at, the letter from DOE and really think about involving children with disabilities in sports, it's out of control. In terms of payment, we're so far away from anything beyond foundations that really will get children involved in equitable ways in their community sports programs when disability is part of the picture.
Okay, well, maybe next year Scott and Melissa will come and talk about financing.